Our reality check today, we have Alan Jernay. He is the co-facilitator of SOCAN, that Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, over in Medford, which our local coastal SOCAN is a part of. And he's here to bring us up to date on policies and everything. It's moving so fast in this area of climate change that we just wanted to get up to speed on some of the great things that are happening out there, as well as some of the concerns. And I wanted to also mention that last night we had a presentation with Bill Bradbury, the previous Oregon Secretary of State, and David Brock Smith stopped in, and it was a really interesting political discussion, as well as other things. And I wanted to bring you some of the highlights of that with Alan, too, who was there and participating. So thanks so much for coming, Alan. It's a pleasure to have you again. How are you doing?
Well, thanks very much indeed for the invitation. I enjoy coming over here to the coast. It turns out that it was a beastly hot few days up in the Rogue Valley, further upriver, and it was just coincidence that that we had planned to come to the coast for the presentation by Bill Bradbury last night that we managed to get away from the heat. And we've just had a delightful couple of days down here on the coast. And again, thanks for the invitation to be here and talk to you about climate stuff.
My pleasure. It was a very interesting talk last night and a lot of participation on all sides. What did you think? What are some of the highlights for you?
Well, I was, first off, I probably should say, I was really impressed by Bill Bradbury's short presentation. It was about 10, 12 minutes, which was stressing the urgency of the situation that we currently find ourselves in.
Exactly.
And that's one of the elements of the problem of global warming and climate change that that we really need to stress to everybody. If folks don't appreciate how urgent it is that we address this problem, then the best I can say is you're really not paying attention. And Bill made a really good point of stressing how urgent that is. So I really enjoyed Bill Bradbury's introduction to the session in that 10-minute session.
Yeah, I was very struck by that too. And also, as David Brock Smith was describing some of the legislation and things like, oh, planting trees. Well, that's wonderful when the trees are going to be doing their thing 20 years from now, but we need action now. And that was a feeling I got from the audience. Many people were speaking up about we need action now.
And that reflects a profound understanding amongst the members of the audience of how serious the problem is, how absolutely urgent it is. This reflects what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has been saying for the last couple of years. If we are going to keep our global warming within something that might be manageable, which is 1.5 degrees centigrade, about 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial temperatures, if we're going to keep the warming to that limit, we absolutely have to act, and we have to act now. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has indicated that we desperately need to be at reducing our emissions 45% below 2010 levels by 2030, and by 2050, we absolutely need to be at net zero emissions of greenhouse gases.
And we're talking about the survival of the human race here.
Or I would say life on the planet as we know it.
Exactly. Not just us, but everything.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that keeps coming home lately, and things are moving so fast in this area that it's hard to stay up to speed. But one of the things that is driving that is things are changing so much faster than the scientists had expected them to, that it's the crisis is here on our doorstep now.
That is exactly right. It's one of the ironies in this whole discussion is how folks who don't accept the scientific consensus about the issue are frequently trying to make the case, that the projections, the model projections of the future are exaggerating the severity of the problem, Whereas when you actually look, as you said, at what's happening, what we find is time and time again, the changes are happening faster than the models have projected. And that's particularly the case with the rate of, for example, one of those iconic elements, the rate of Arctic ice melt, dwindling ice melt during the summer. And that's particularly true with sea level rise.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening faster than the models have expected us. And even global warming itself is continuing at the high end of the range at which the models have projected. The models usually have a series of four levels of greenhouse gas emissions, and we are on the highest trajectory, which in the range of models is the most severe. And so the business as usual, as it's called, scenario is the worst case scenario in the range of models that have been used. And that is an element that many folks just don't understand.
I hate to be an alarmist and say things like the end of the human race as we know it, you know, but that's really what we're facing. And yet there is hope. It's not impossible. And I guess I always want to throw that in when I say something like that, because I think people feel like it's hopeless and there's nothing to be done. But do you know Tom Suchanek? He was on not long ago, and he is coming to talk in October. He said, we absolutely have the technology to beat this thing.
Oh,
It's not like we can sit back and let science take care of it for us. We have to do our part.
Totally agree with that.
But it's not a question of can it be fixed. It's the will of the people to fix it.
That's exactly where we are. And you express reticence to use the term alarmist. And of course, those of us who are arguing for urgent action to address the problem are constantly accused of being alarmists.
Right.
And as you mentioned to begin with, my background is in science, it's in biology, and it was that brought me to this fight, recognizing the impact of the projections on natural systems, on our forests, on our grasslands, on our deserts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was that stimulated my feeling of responsibility to get involved. Once I looked at the projections and said, well, if these happen, our natural systems are really threatened.
Yes.
And that means both our agriculture and our forestry, and let's throw in our fisheries as well, are also threatened. Yes, if you understand the science, I would say it's impossible not to be alarmed.
One of the things that Bill brought out last night, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact year that he said this would happen by, but he said 50% of species will be gone. And all of these things, we can look at them individually and say, oh, the fisheries are under stress and this is happening and that's happening. But when you start looking at 50% of species are gone, that means our whole ecosystem, the thing that keeps us alive on the planet, mm-hmm. is going to be completely torn apart.
There is an abundance of evidence to suggest that we are right now confronting our planet. We humans are imposing on our planet the sixth extinction. And what that means is, in geological time since the evolution of the initiation of life on the planet, we can look back and see five times over the history of life on the planet when there have been massive extinctions. We don't really necessarily understand exactly what drove all of them,
mm-hmm.
but some of them we can look back and say, climate change, a very sudden climate change happened here, and that coincided with a massive extinction of species. Sometimes up to 90-95% of the species on the planet just went extinct. And then what happened after that was evolution again took over, and the number of species climbed and climbed and climbed. And then something else happened, and there was another massive extinction of something like 90-95% of life on the planet. and what we are in danger of doing to our planet right now is imposing a sixth such event.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's 50% of life forms, I think Bill was talking about 50% of terrestrial life. I'm not sure, again, what the exact numbers were. And whether it's 50% or not, and when that's going to happen, we're not certain. But we're certainly imposing the kind of stresses on the planet that are likely to do that. And we can look at what's happening now and see we are beginning to do it.
Yes. It's really an amazing time to be facing all of these things. I know one of the things we were talking about earlier before we got on the air was about the Doug Fir. And mm-hmm. I know that we've got a lot of, sudden oak death and different things that are attacking other species around. But locally, we've been saying, oh, isn't that great that the Doug Firs are surviving so well and they're not under attack. But you're telling me that in Medford, they're already...
Oh, well, yes. My wife and I live in the Applegate Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see, we're on 20 acres, we're in a valley, and we can see orange spots throughout the forest around us. And when you go out there, you see this is a Douglas fir that is expiring.
Mm-hmm.
And on our particular 20 acres, we have taken down probably 24 Douglas firs that are either dead or dying over the last 2 years. And uh-huh. this is happening throughout the Applegate Valley. And I was talking to a friend in the climate activist arena about the Willamette Valley. And he was pointing out that indeed the same thing is happening up there. Now, across Oregon, this becomes critical because I think it's something like 60% of the commercial trees in Oregon are
Doug fir.
Doug fir, and that's about the rate at which the timber industry harvests Douglas fir as part of its commercial crop. And it's long been a source of irony to me, bemusement maybe as another word, that folks in the timber industry are not at the top of the list of individuals who are urging upon our state and federal government action to address global warming, because unless we contain global warming, their whole industry is, to not to put too fine a point on it, down the toilet.
Yeah.
Because the species upon which they rely will find themselves in geographic locations where the climate is no longer able to support them.
Right.
When I talk about this issue, folks not unreasonably will often ask me, so what do you think the forests of Oregon are look like? Well, so let's say Southwest Oregon. What do you think they're going to look like in 100 years? And I will say, I if I'm being honest, the answer is I really don't know, but I will often answer that with tongue in cheek, maybe, by saying, well, I think we're going to have a lot of Joshua trees, and they're not going to be much use for the timber industry.
No, not your best crop. You were showing me earlier some graphs that came out of some scientific research that's being used for the legislature to base some of their work on. Is that right? Is
well,
that what
one
that
of the
from?
Things that Southern Oregon Climate Action Now has done. And we did this maybe 4 years, 5 years ago. We developed what we call the Oregon Legislative District Project, and we developed a summary of the climate trends, projections, and consequences for each of Oregon's Senate districts. And once we have them for each Senate district, that means, because of the way Oregon is set up politically,
mm-hmm.
that means we have one of these summaries for each House district, since each Senate district is exactly two House districts.
Right.
How convenient is that?
It is.
So we have these for every legislative district. And
for the whole state.
For the whole state.
That's
right.
Great.
And what's happening right at this minute, well, I should say during this month, I am going through these and trying to update them, because we developed them 3 to 4 years ago with interns at Southern Oregon University. And as you will appreciate, our understanding of these issues has progressed. Actual trends have gone on 3 or 4 years longer, so we can update the graphs of what's happening. And so I'm going through these and updating them. And how imaginative of me, I started with Senate District 1, which is where we are.
Right.
And so we have this updated, and now what I'm doing is sharing this with folks who live in Senate District 1 and asking them to look at this and say to me, well, does that feel accurate to you? Is there mm-hmm. something I'm missing?
Mm-hmm.
And so these are posted on our website at socan.eco, and anybody who lives anywhere can just look at our summaries for each legislative district if they want to. And I will say this, what I have posted at the moment is a draft. So when I get feedback from the folks that I'm asking to mm-hmm. review these documents, they'll be updated. And it's always good to get folks who actually live in the district to look at it and say, I don't know, that doesn't feel right. Mm-hmm. And then we can go back and see whether it's accurate or needs
right.
to be modified.
And once you have that draft solidified to its final version, then you make that available to the legislators.
Everybody,
so,
yes.
Yeah.
What I was doing during the last legislative session, as House Bill 2020 was being discussed, I was sharing these with legislators to fulfill the reality or whatever. That's not quite the right phrase, but so that we could demonstrate to the legislators what's actually happening in their backyard. It's too easy, I think, for legislators to not realize that global warming has an impact directly on their constituents. It tends to be a somewhat abstract idea, but one of the things that we understand from the arena of climate change communication is the best way to get folks to really understand what's going on in a global level is to bring it on home to them and say, well, this is what's happening in your backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And unless we collectively take steps to address this problem, the problems that you're facing in your backyard are only going to get worse.
What was that like when you were reaching out to the legislators?
It depends. Some of them. It was actually very interesting. I sent a copy of the legislative district summary to Tiffany Mitchell, who is a House representative from up in the Northwest. She's a new rep. And one of the things that I got a call back almost instantly from her policy advisor, chief of staff, or whatever the name of the person was in her mm-hmm. office, saying, do you mind if I share these with the timber industry? Because he said, you know, I was really impressed by the evidence that you were presenting on the future of our commercially important tree species. One of the things that we are doing in these summaries is tailoring them to each district. So the tree species that are listed in Oregon Senate District 1 are not the same tree species that necessarily are included in Senate District 5 or Senate District 8 or whatever.
All right.
So we're trying to make these relevant to that Senate district. And so the tree species that I have listed under Senate District 1 are the tree species that are commercially important from Curry County, Coos County, Douglas County, which is where Senate District 1 is, whereas the tree species that are critical up in the Pacific, up in the northwestern corner of Oregon, are not necessarily the same species.
Right, right. So you did get a very mixed bag when you talked to them a couple years back.
Well,
this was the original report.
Yeah, I was doing that this spring,
okay.
In connection with the House bill that just
2020.
Just failed in the Senate because of the mm-hmm. Republican walkout.
Right, right.
And it depended. Some representatives simply, I'm guessing, just ignored it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did get, as I mentioned, from House Representative Tiffany Mitchell and other representatives and senators, I did get a positive response expressing appreciation for the information.
Well, that's great. I was very taken aback and pleased to hear David Brock-Smith last night say that he was not a climate denier.
And I have heard him say that before. And So I take him at his word. I think that's probably the correct. He is perfectly willing to accept the science, which is telling us this is a problem and it's urgent.
Yeah, yeah. He said a number of things that were quite interesting and very detailed about the process around 2020, for instance. Did you get any interesting takeaways that you'd like to share?
I think in one of the things that struck me particularly that he said was not only that he accepts that this is an urgent problem, that global warming is happening and we need to address it, but the thing that I heard him say, which I was surprised by, was the acknowledgement that we need to reach net zero emissions. And he acknowledged not only that we need to reach net zero emissions and that we need a bill to do that, but that we should be achieving net zero emissions sooner than 2050.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really, I thought, interesting, because most legislation that we see coming through targets 2050 as the point where we need to be at net zero emissions. And the legislation does that because that's what the IPCC in its Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in its 2018 report indicated was the deadline by which we need to be at net zero.
But that's before we got all the new science.
Well, that was 2018, so that's relatively recent, but I will say that when we look at that, I think that 2050 net zero emissions is based on something like, if we do that, we have a 66% chance of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial. That's not a guarantee. These things are all couched in terms of probabilities.
Right.
So it's
66% doesn't sound
all that high.
That's
a two-thirds chance.
Yeah.
And when I say that, don't hold me to that percentage, but because I may have that one wrong, but it's
but
not
something
a
in that ballpark.
Something
anyway.
Like
yeah.
that. It's not for sure. It's not a certainty.
Right.
So we're constantly juggling with probabilities, and we need to be as certain as we can. That presupposes, of course, that we want our kids and our grandkids and our great-grandkids to enjoy a planet which is livable, which offers them the chance to enjoy life as we have enjoyed it, or are enjoying it, I should say. But again, it's not a guarantee. You know, it's like being diagnosed with a disease and being offered a treatment.
Mm-hmm.
The treatment isn't a guarantee.
No.
You know, and having gone through acute myeloid leukemia myself, I understand that.
Right.
And I understand what happens if we simply say, well, all hope is lost. Well, yeah, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we have any hope to keep going as a species with a planet that is remotely similar to the one that we currently enjoy, we have to grasp at what is possible to correct the problem, and that involves reducing our emissions and extracting greenhouse gases from the atmosphere.
And I guess the thing that I come back to often in my own musings about it all is that when we use numbers like, or years like 2050, it makes people feel like, well, I can go for another 20 years, you know, 19 years and 6 months before I have to think about this.
that's the illusion, unfortunately. You know, the science can give us these kind of calculations, and I understand how they're based. We can look at what concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is likely to induce what amount of warming? And we can look at the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere now, and we can figure out how many tons of greenhouse gases it will take for us to emit to reach that limit. And so that's where we say we need to be at net zero emissions by 2050. But that doesn't mean in 2049 we can be doing what we're doing now.
Right.
I mean, what we need to be doing, and that's why the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has put this, in order to reach that target, we need to be 45% below 2010 emissions by 2030.
And our emissions have just been going up, even though we've had our warning shots.
Oh, yeah. A colleague sent me an opinion column somewhere in which he said, this is alarming, but educational. And my response to him was, it wasn't exactly duh, but what he had sent me was an article which said, the idea that we have 12 years to get to 45% below 2010 emissions, that's fine, but that means we absolutely need to be doing something now.
Yes.
We can't just go until, again, 2029 and say, okay, well, next year we need to be 45% down from 2010. Let's get on it.
And the other thing that plays into this really dramatically, I think, is that the longer we wait and the more we let things get out of control, the more expensive it's going to be, the more difficult it's going to be, and the more it's going to really impact our lifestyle in ways we aren't going to like. The need for change is going to be a lot less demanding on us the sooner we get it together and start doing things.
That's totally correct. And this is one of the most disappointing elements of the failure of the Oregon legislature to pass House Bill 2020 in the recent session. If we don't, exactly what you said, the sooner we do it, the shallower, if you like, the downward trajectory has to be. The longer we put it off, the steeper that downward trajectory has to be in order to meet those goals, and inevitably the more disruptive it's going to be from a social and economic point of view.
Yes. You're listening to KCIW LP, Curry Coast Community Radio, 100.7 FM in beautiful Brookings, Oregon. So in terms of your mission and speaking to us folks here in Brookings, long as you're here, what do you want to say to us that we might not already be aware of in this area? If you had, a really big billboard you could put in the center of Brookings, what would it say right now?
I think it would say, global warming is here and now. We must act.
Mm-hmm. The urgency of it all.
Yes, and this was the message that Bill was bringing to the meeting last night, really. And I thought that was entirely appropriate.
Absolutely. And as a layperson without a science background, as I look around and see all these dramatic weather changes and catastrophes happening everywhere, I think that you talk about the IPCC report from 2018. I imagine that is based on science that came before 2018.
Oh, yes, totally.
And now we're at the end of 2019, and so far it looks like everything's accelerating at the maximum level that
It does seem that way.
You know, but we won't have the science to really back that up for a while yet. By the time we get there, that science will be out. Do we fly by the seat of our pants here, or how do we quantify what's going on in a way that's meaningful when it's changing so fast?
Yeah, that's an interesting element. One of the things that we don't often think about. But it's certainly true that when a report, such as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, comes out, that report is based on the peer-reviewed published literature. And it takes time to evaluate all of that literature and develop a report. So exactly, a report that comes out in 2018 is probably based on literature that was published at least as recently as, let's say, 2017, and that means the actual research or understanding that is in that 2018 IPCC report is going back even earlier than that, because it takes time for somebody's research to get written up into a manuscript, to get submitted to a journal, to go through the journal's review process, and then end up in print. So the actual research, the knowledge that is in that 2018 IPCC report, is probably coming from maybe 2016 or 2015 mm-hmm. actual research.
Yeah.
So it's already 2 to 3 years out of date, if you like, by mm-hmm. the time that IPCC report comes out.
But we do have some factual information that we can rely on that is good to know. And I don't have the exact numbers in my head, but I believe that Brock Smith was quoting that in Oregon we were using something like 60.
Oh, we do have,
you know what,
yes,
I'm talking
but
about?
Those the data, yeah, okay, who was talking about the greenhouse gas emissions that are measured from the assessment of in-boundary emissions of greenhouse gases. And the most recent data that we have on those are 2017.
Okay.
We have tentative data, I think, for mm-hmm. 2018, but that's tentative. And we don't know for sure, but that puts us in Oregon at something around 60 to 65 million metric tons of greenhouse gas emissions.
And we were sequestering about half of that.
Well, what's happening is that's the annual emissions mm-hmm. of greenhouse gases from the state of Oregon. Now, there are certain activities that are happening in Oregon that are sucking up greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. And our trees, as Representative Brock Smith accurately pointed out, are tremendous vehicles, if you like, mm-hmm. not a good word, but for extracting greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. They really suck up a lot of greenhouse gases. So indeed, they absorb, capture, sequester, store some 30 million metric tons of greenhouse gases annually, largely carbon dioxide, because that's what trees suck up when they're photosynthesizing, reasonably. But then we've got to allow for the fact that whilst the trees are sucking up greenhouse gases, we're also logging forests, and mm-hmm. the logging activity itself is resulting in the emissions of greenhouse gases.
When the tree gets cut, it emits a lot of what it stored, is that right?
Well,
something like
when we harvest, when you look at that, what's happening to a tree once it's harvested, right, that tree is hauled to a lumber mill. And let's go back even before the tree is hauled, right? The branches are slashed off.
Yes.
Because we're not actually processing the branches and the leaves. They get slashed off and left behind. What happens to them? They probably piled up and burned. Where does that carbon dioxide go? Into the atmosphere. So then the trunk of the tree essentially gets hauled to the sawmill, mm-hmm. and then it's the bark is
stripped away,
shipped off, is pulled off, and mm-hmm. what happens to that? Probably piled up, probably burned, carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Then it's sawn into logs, so we have piles of sawdust. What happens to them? They either decay or are burned, and
right.
And unless we use them for something, which happens to a small percentage. And then the timber that results from that is transported, processed. And so there's a whole bunch of greenhouse gases that are emitted as a result of the processing. So when a log appears at Home Depot or Lowe's, for example, and we measure the amount of carbon that's in that compared to the initial tree, it turns out that's possibly 15%. So as we have harvested and transported our timber to the store for us to use, we have actually emitted something like 85% of the carbon that was in it. And then and that includes the emissions that result from the equipment that we've been using.
Right.
So in addition, when we're working this equation and we're talking about how much our trees sequester in terms of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, we also have to factor into the equation the amount of emissions that result from our harvesting those trees.
It seems like our economic models are really not adequate these days for what we're facing, because we have all these drains on us, the way we're messing up our ecology in all these various ways, and the way we're consuming our resources, like our dug furs and so forth, and it's just not in the equation at all. So we can say, oh yeah, you know, stock market's doing wonderful, but in the meanwhile, we're depleting this planet on an incredible pace.
Yes, and that does become a real challenge to us, and one of the things that I think we have to try and do is incorporate into our thinking a recognition that the economic model doesn't necessarily do what we want it to do if we are concerned about ongoing sustainably management of our system. And there's an element that you didn't mention, which I think is critical, and that is when we think about a company, and let's pick a timber mill, there's an element that really is important and which is critical in the economic system, and that is the funding of that activity. And so we have a timber processing plant. The first thing that has to happen is whoever's going to build a timber plant probably gets a loan from the bank in order to subsidize their ability to construct that plant. And they immediately have a financial responsibility to pay off the loan.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have shareholders who are they have a fiduciary responsibility, and that is a responsibility to provide their shareholders with dividends. So they have instantly, as soon as they've started acting in the timber business, they have a financial incentive to maximize their profit so that they can pay off the loan and provide dividends.
Right.
And that doesn't necessarily lead them to manage the resource sustainably, because they have a pressure to pay off rather than sustainably manage the system.
And it seems like, you know, that's kind of the usual scenario in all the corporations about needing to maximize profit for the shareholders and all of that. But there was recently a group of business leaders who got together and wrote a new mission statement, as it were. You know about that.
That's interesting, because we were talking about this the other day. And in addition, the normal rules of corporation, incorporation for businesses, have the standard fiduciary responsibility on the part of managers to maximize profits for shareholders. But there's a different kind of a corporation, which is called a B Corp, which stands for benefit corporation. And companies that have adopted incorporation rules based on benefit corporation principles, in addition to saying they have a responsibility to maximize income to their shareholders, they say, we have a responsibility to manage our resources sustainably. We have a responsibility to our workers and to our environment. And so what those kind of corporations have said in their incorporation principles is, we are not going to play that game that says the only purpose for our existence is to make profits. They have said our responsibility, our duty, is also to manage our environment and also to be just to our workers. So those are B corporations, and they do exist. And the thing that you just described, and when I heard that, I was hearing was the sort of major corporations in the country getting together and saying, oh gosh darn it, maybe we should all be B corporations.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should all be good citizens.
What a concept.
You know, I'm back to duh.
Yeah. Well, for me, when I hear that, I wonder, you know, proof's in the pudding, right? How do they restructure things so that the decision makers' bonuses aren't based on profit and so forth and so on to make it actually a reality? That's the catch,
I like,
isn't
yes,
it?
Yeah, yeah. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. Let's see. Yeah, it's nice words, and we get that a lot.
Yes.
Yeah, nice words. We love it, love it. Now let's see what you actually do.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Why don't they restructure themselves as B corporations, and so then it's written into their basic
bylaws,
principles of corporation, incorporation, yeah.
Well, so what else is happening on the political stage right now that, I mean, I'm so curious about, is 2020 ever, in some form, ever going to get passed, et cetera, et cetera?
The answer to that question is, I think we don't know. There are a lot of, there's a lot of conversation going on, as you would expect. There are things happening within the legislature amongst legislators, and I am not privy to those.
Right.
I am aware of what the discussions are going on in amongst the folks in the Climate Coalition. We think that there's going to be some kind of legislation introduced in 2020, but the problem with 2020 legislature is not, folks don't necessarily know this. This is a little tangential educational thing.
Okay.
The way the Oregon legislature works is they alternate long sessions with short sessions. So this year was a long 6-month session. During a 6-month session, there is time for committees to engage in discussions of bills and incorporate amendments and so on and so forth. And so there is time for all of that to happen, sometimes too much time. I think that's what happened with HB 2020. Rather than putting it on fast track to get it through early, it was on a slow track, and it was being nibbled at all the way through the session. So that's the long session, and that alternates with the short session. So the long sessions are on odd years,
right?
2019. So the even year then is a short session. It's about, I think, 35 days. So it's maybe 6 weeks. Is that 6 weeks? Six, five, something
yeah,
like that.
Something like
6 weeks. So essentially what has to happen if a bill is going to pass through the short session, it has to be good to go on day one.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't time to submit a bill to the long, tedious processes of committee hearings and amendments. So if something's going to pass in 2020, that bill has to be identified as being absolutely top priority by everybody who is in leadership, and it has to be ready to go day one, pretty
and
much.
And we're going to have the same legislators that we had time to turn it down. Who did turn it down, I should say, because there aren't going to be any new elections between now and then.
Yeah, the odd thing about the 2020 session is we really don't know what would have happened in the Senate had the bill been allowed to receive a vote. As David Brocksmith pointed out yesterday, there were three Democratic senators who were, let's say, wobbly. One was almost certainly going to vote no, and that's Betsy Johnson from Senate District 16, I think it was, up Tillamook, Scappoose, Astoria.
Uh-huh.
And then there was Arnie Roblin in Senate District 5, who was not sure, and Laurie Monis Anderson, and I do not know which Senate district she is, but it's Gresham, where Boeing is, and she was a little wobbly, but it's not clear if a vote had actually happened in the Senate. It's not clear whether either Laurie Mona Sanderson or Arnie Roblin would have been willing to be the vote that killed the bill.
Uh-huh.
So when push came to shove, they might have said to themselves, my place in history is going to be determined by this vote. I have to be on board with it.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know.
Yeah.
And the fact that the Republicans, this is kind of an interesting aside, but the fact that the Republicans elected to walk out of the Senate rather than risk a vote because they felt if there were a vote, they would potentially lose. The fact that they walked out means their intelligence told them this bill might pass if there's a vote.
Right.
And so we don't know what would have happened. So we can't say the vote was, the bill was defeated. It just never got a hearing.
So we have some time between now and then. Mm-hmm. And if public sentiment and pressure mm-hmm. shifts the tide, that could make a difference.
It could do. And yes, we're certainly, those of us who are engaged in the climate movement are very much very conscious of our need to exert some influence on those representatives, senators who were wobbly.
And we come, you know, almost full circle to where we started in this conversation, which is that it's not about can we fix it, it's do we have the will.
Mm-hmm.
And so to my thinking now, the priority is almost to get everybody to educate themselves and then educate their neighbor.
Mm-hmm. Totally. I would really like to see that happening. Yeah.
Because that's what's going to be critical, is to make that kind of effort like we had in World War II or when we put somebody on the moon, that
yes.
everybody is pulling on the oars.
Yes. It really is disturbing that we are still in a situation where there are some folks who even if they claim that they accept the science, actually behave as though they don't. That really is disturbing.
Hold that thought. I have to just say,
yes.
You are listening to KCIWLP, Curry Coast Community Radio, 100.7 FM in beautiful Brookings, Oregon. Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, David Brock Smith said that he felt that not all, but most of our Republican legislators
mm-hmm. yes.
are not denying climate anymore and are willing to start making some moves on it, which is good news. But, I mean, here we are in Oregon, one of the most progressive states in the country, and we can't get it done? You know, that's insane.
It is. That's one of the most disturbing elements. And people across the United States were looking at Oregon for exactly that reason.
Yes.
Thinking, well, Oregon, there they are. They have a supermajority of apparently individuals in the Senate and the House who accept the science.
Mm-hmm.
Surely they can get it done.
Right.
And then we find that there's all of this money coming into the state from the Koch brothers, from timber,
mm-hmm.
to defeat meaningful greenhouse gas emissions reduction policy in the state. And folks across the country are looking at that saying, well, goodness gracious, if they can't get it done in Oregon, how are we going to get it done in Idaho?
Yes, exactly.
Georgia
especially.
Whatever.
Not to pick on Georgia, but it was a sitting duck I had to. Well, in terms of the Republicans that we do have in our legislature, one would assume that they're somewhat centrist to be representing.
You would think.
They wouldn't yes. be the extremists for the most part. There's
mm-hmm.
probably exceptions.
Yes.
So, you know, we should be able to get this done, and yet here we sit, you know.
Yes, people are fighting over the details instead of saying we absolutely have to do something. Let's compromise our peculiarities, our small details, concerns, and get something done. That one of the interesting things about Senate Bill 2020, House Bill 2020, was that although it would have been, in my judgment, one of the strongest greenhouse gas emissions reductions programs in the country, even that did not target net zero emissions by 2050. And that was because it was felt to identify that as a goal in a bill was political suicide. So the bill really had 80% below 1990 emissions levels as its goal for 2050.
And that's so far away.
And that those of us who understand the science were prepared to say, okay, that's not really, we know that's not what we need, but we do need to start on a serious emissions reduction trajectory. That may not quite be the trajectory we need, but so long as we start, when the political will rises for the action that we need, then we can come back and modify our goals and say, okay, we're on a trajectory for 80% reductions. We just need to tweak that to get us down to net zero emissions by 2050. And that will not be as disruptive a change as going from nothing to that goal.
Exactly. And just for the sake of anybody who doesn't know, could you define net zero, what that means?
Oh, okay, net zero, that's a good point. Net zero emissions means that what we are doing is we're living in a state, because it's all boundary-driven, the state of Oregon. So as much greenhouse gases as we emit are sucked up. Mm-hmm. By things like our trees and our agricultural activities. Our land is sucking up that. So when you balance what we're emitting with what is being captured, it's zero. And the reason that is important, I think, to understand it's net zero is if we say we need to have zero emissions of greenhouse gases by 2050, what that actually means is you and I have to stop breathing.
Yes, that's right.
which is
carbon dioxide, aren't we?
we unfortunately we are. We do exhale out carbon dioxide. So I think we have to be net zero. So we have to have, for every time we exhale, we need a plant sucking up the carbon dioxide we exhale and sequestering it. So that's
exactly
what net zero means.
Thank you for that. You were talking about forestry pouring money in to defeat 2020 and so forth.
Our timber industry, yeah.
Yeah, and it just seems so ironic when you can see that what's happening is actually killing their industry.
Yeah, I cannot fathom why that is, unless it's that economic problem that we talked about a little earlier, that they have to harvest the trees as fast as they can in order to pay off the loans and the shareholders. If the shareholders said to the timber company owners, "No, we'll accept lower dividends if you protect the forests," that could happen.
Right. So it's really a lot on the part of the shareholders too to make their will known.
I would say so.
If they're in the mood to do that.
Yes.
You know.
If the shareholders are willing to say, I mean, then that is where we all are. If we accept there is a problem, we have to accept that we must make some sacrifices in order to address it. And the way to balance that is to say, well, and you know, Bill Bradbury was showing some nice slides. Nice is not the right word,
scary,
but slides
of
what the planet's going to look like if we don't address this. And the answer is we're going to be parched.
Yeah,
we're going to probably be out of agriculture, out of forestry, and out of fisheries. How much is that going to cost us?
Oh yeah, I mean the thing to, I think, make it real for people to talk a little bit about what's going to happen to their food bill. Are you going to be able to afford to eat when all of this is
ignored? Or is there going to be any food?
Period. Well, yeah. That's it. I mean, it's going to force the price of food up to a point where a lot of people...
Only the fat cats,
that's
if
right,
you like,
right.
are going to be able to afford the food.
Take care of the population problem, right?
Yeah, that's not funny.
No, it isn't, but it is really pretty true.
And I will just make a point. One of the things that I think is critical, and I'm not alone, good heavens, is we have to do all of this with an eye to social justice, so that it's not just the people who are already affluent who are benefiting. We've got to recognize that there are elements in our society who are already suffering more than average because of our behavior. And one of the things that the House Bill 2020 did was invest the funds that were generated into addressing social justice problems.
Oh, that's good to know. I didn't realize that.
That is a critical element. You know, and it's interesting because one component of the bill which did upset a number of folks because they thought it was watering the bill down was that the bill allowed for utilities to get some free allowances to cover the potential cost of increasing rates for low-income Oregonians.
Mm-hmm.
And the bill included an element where industries which were defined as emissions-intensive or trade-exposed, emissions-intensive meaning in order to conduct their business, they inherently need a lot of energy.
Yes.
And so produce a lot of emissions. And trade-exposed industries are those that would suffer if there were emissions regulations in the state of Oregon, but in Idaho there are none, so they could sort of move to Idaho where they could pollute at will.
Right.
So the way that the bill worked was it gave allowance to those industries so that the industries were somewhat protected from the rigors of the bill, and the folks who worked at those industries were not put out of work. So there were a lot of elements in it that addressed social justice.
Seems really quite reasonable. We're at the end of our time. I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and explaining some of these political aspects as well as everything else we talked about. It's been great having you, Alan. This is Alan Journay with us from SOCAN, Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. And I want to mention again your website, socan.eco, SOCAN.eco. It's a huge resource, and it also has some pages about Coastal SOCAN, what we're doing here in town, too.
Mm-hmm.
I want
yes.
to thank also Pi White, our technical support and co-producer. This is Lee Tooley. Thanks so much for listening to Reality Check on KCIW.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.